Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we are extracting the most crucial insights from a really fascinating piece of source material.
Yeah, it's a great one.
It really is. It's a highly detailed campaign log from the tabletop role-playing world of Mirari.
Right.
And our mission for this deep dive is to see what a fantasy adventure can actually teach you about, well, asymmetrical problem-solving, psychological resilience, and group dynamics.
Because there is a lot to unpack
Oh,
here.
absolutely. So we are following this very eclectic band of adventurers. You have Hannah, who is a young fey warrior of the Golden Hawks.
Okay.
Then there's Sam, an ancient and somewhat cynical fairy minstrel. Rosie, who is this treasure-obsessed half-goblin, half-dog creature. They call it a
I'm
doglin.
a doglin, yeah, I love that.
Right. And then Eyes, a massive sentient mountain cat. And Peaches, who is a very glamorous knight steed horse.
It is quite the roster. I mean, truly. And what makes this particular log so compelling is that it completely subverts the standard expectations you have of a dungeon crawl.
Oh, for sure.
Usually, you anticipate a purely physical challenge, like you kick down the door, you fight the monster, you grab the loot.
The classic setup.
Exactly. But the scenario this group walks into is entirely different. Their mission is to infiltrate an ancient frost-covered fortress to rescue a group of prisoners.
Right.
But the antagonist waiting for them doesn't just want to eat them or fight them in a traditional sense. She wants to break them down mentally before they even have a chance to draw their weapons.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because their initial entry into the fortress is just dripping with tension.
It really is.
They don't just kick down a door. They have to squeeze behind this musty, ancient tapestry depicting old wars. And they step out onto a frost-covered balcony. And they're like three stories up.
Yeah, way up there.
And they look down into a room that is breathtaking, but instantly terrifying. I mean, sunlight is filtering through these massive arch windows, hitting towering pillars of ice.
And the ice glows, right?
Yeah, it glows from within with this prismatic rainbow light. And scattered all around the floor is this massive treasure hoard. But, and here's the kicker, when they look closely at those glowing ice pillars, they realize there are shadowy masses trapped inside.
Bodies,
Yeah.
perfectly preserved sentient
All right,
beings.
this isn't just a lair, it's a gallery. And the curator of this gallery is Velenes.
The crystalline ice dragon.
Exactly. She is easily two stories tall, but her physical size isn't even the scariest part. She is nearly transparent. She shimmers like a diamond.
Which means you can barely even see her outline until she's practically breathing right on you.
Yes, which is such a terrifying visual. But her physical presence is almost secondary to her true weapon.
Right, because Valanice is a psychological threat.
Exactly.
I mean, most dragons hoard gold or magical artifacts, right? Valanice hoards history. She literally freezes legendary beings alive and treats them as trophies.
So twisted.
She literally refers to them as her gallery.
I kept thinking of her like the most toxic art collector imaginable.
Oh, that's a perfect way to put it.
Right. Someone who views living, breathing history as a mere commodity. Just something to be put on a shelf so she can admire her own dominance.
Yeah.
And the source log details who some of these frozen victims are. There's Prince Feasel, who's a goblin. There's Elysia, who's known across this entire world as the legendary bandit queen.
A huge figure in the lore.
Massive figure. And then there is a feather deeply personal to the adventuring group, Line.
Ah, yes.
He's the great-grandfather of Eyes, the giant mountain cat that's traveling with them.
And Valanice knows exactly who she has in her collection. And more importantly, she knows exactly who just stepped onto her balcony.
Which brings up a huge question for me. And I kind of have to push back a little on the group's survival instincts here.
Okay, let's hear it.
If I step onto a balcony and a two-story invisible diamond dragon drops from the ceiling and immediately starts taunting me about my family trauma, I am
You're
running.
out of there.
I don't care about the treasure. I am out of there. Why didn't they just bolt the second they realized they were entirely outmatched?
Well, what's fascinating here is that running simply wasn't a tactical option, both physically and
Oh,
psychologically.
so.
Physically, they are deep inside a fortified tower and it's surrounded by wyverns.
Right, the lesser dragons.
Exactly. They are relentlessly patrolling the skies outside. If the group runs, they are just picked off in the open.
Okay, that makes sense.
But psychologically, Velenice intentionally paralyzes her prey. She doesn't just breathe fire or ice right away. She zeroes in on Eyes the mountain cat and starts detailing his family's darkest, most painful secret.
Oh, man. She reveals that Line, the frozen cat in the pillar, had this bitter, terrible falling out with his adoptive father, this legendary figure named Thomas.
Right.
And Lyon basically abandoned his father out of pride, and Thomas ultimately died alone. And Valenice just uses this deep generational shame to completely unmoor Eyes.
It's brutal.
It really is.
Yeah.
Imagine being in a high-stakes meeting or, you know, a critical moment in your life.
Yeah.
And someone suddenly weaponizes your deepest personal failure against you just to watch you freeze up.
Just to watch you flinch.
Exactly. That is what is happening here. She is pouring salt in generational wounds for fun.
That is the perfect analogy. It is classic narcissistic manipulation. I mean, she thrives on cruelty and the feeling of superiority way more than immediate slaughter. She wants to play with her food.
Right.
But her need to emotionally dominate them is exactly what creates her fatal flaw. She assumes they are completely broken by her psychological warfare.
So she gets arrogant.
Exactly. So instead of killing them while they're stunned, she orchestrates a game for her own entertainment.
A twisted gladiator match.
Right.
Because she just loves the drama, right? She actually thaws out Alesia, the legendary bandit queen.
Yeah.
And she tells Hannah, the young Fae warrior, that they have to fight to the death. She tells them the winner might get to leave, but the loser stays frozen in the gallery forever.
It's the ultimate sadistic power play. She fully expects them to turn on each other like animals.
But Hannah refuses the premise of the game entirely, which I loved.
It's such a good moment. Instead of drawing her sword and going on the offensive, Hannah draws her hunting knife, walks straight up to the bandit queen, hands her the weapon handle first, and simply says, "Kill me."
Which completely changes the threat matrix.
Totally.
By refusing to fight, she robs the dragon of the entertainment she was craving. Hannah basically decides she would rather die on her own terms than be forced to murder a stranger for a tyrant's amusement.
And that single shocking act of vulnerable defiance shifts the entire momentum of the encounter. Because Alesia, who, you know, was historically a villain in this world.
Right, she's the bandit queen.
She takes the knife, looks at Hannah, and whispers, "Trust me," and suddenly they put on a show.
It is brilliant. They engage in total kayfabe.
Kayfabe, yes.
And for anyone listening who isn't familiar with the term, kayfabe is that old pro wrestling trick where performers maintain the absolute illusion of a bitter, unscripted rivalry to manipulate the audience.
Yep.
Hannah and Alesia pretend to fight to the death. They're slashing, tumbling around, screaming, but they are secretly coordinating every single movement right in front of the referee.
It's so smart.
And the detail that really sells this is Sam, the old minstrel. He realizes exactly what they are doing, so he starts aggressively playing his lute, singing this sweeping, epic ballad about the bandit queen to provide a sensory distraction.
It is a masterclass in asymmetrical problem solving. I mean, Valenice has all the physical power in the world, but her ego makes her blind to misdirection.
She just wants a good show.
Exactly. She is so caught up in the spectacle, the dramatic music, and the perceived bloodshed that she doesn't notice what Alesia is actually doing.
Which is using magic, right?
Yes. During the staged fight, Alesia uses her dark magic, because she was once known as a witch queen, to secretly enchant the dagger Hannah gave her. So when she finally winds up for the dramatic killing blow, she ducks past Hannah and hurls the dagger straight at the two-story dragon.
And Valenice literally laughs. She sees this tiny hunting knife flying at her massive diamond scales and thinks it's a joke.
Until the enchanted dagger hits her chest and violently explodes into a blinding wall of white-hot flame.
It is such an incredible turning point.
Yeah.
Because it proves that you don't always need to match your opponent's raw strength.
Right.
Alesia uses cunning, her decades of combat experience, and the very darkness of her past to outsmart an apex predator.
And that firewall buys them precious seconds.
Yeah.
But Alesia knows a terrifying truth about crystalline dragons. You cannot physically kill Valenice by just blowing up her body.
Wait, really? Why not?
Because her essence, her core, is magically hidden somewhere else in the fortress as a separate heart. Mm-hmm. As long as that heart is intact, the physical body in the gallery will just keep regenerating.
Oh, that is terrifying. So they have to split the party. It's the only tactical choice. Mm-hmm. Alesia and I stay behind in the burning gallery to physically hold off this furious regenerating ice dragon, while Hannah, Sam, and Rosie the Doglin sprint deeper into the fortress to find and destroy the heart.
which logically leads them into a frantic, terrifying ascent. I mean, they are sprinting up a winding, claustrophobic tower staircase, and they are immediately pursued by the wyverns that were patrolling outside.
And Hannah is holding these wyverns off with this ancient magic bow they managed to snatch from the treasure hoard.
Yeah, that bow is wild.
It doesn't use normal arrows. It shoots these screaming bolts of pure concentrated light that just vaporize the wyverns on impact. It is pure chaos.
The adrenaline is off the charts.
But then, right in the middle of this sprint, they slam into a trap.
A very grim, very lethal trap. They come across a steep section of the stairs that is entirely littered with the skeletons of dead dwarves.
Just bones everywhere.
Yeah. And Rosie, using her heightened dogland senses, catches a faint, distinct smell in the air. Almonds.
Cyanide. It's a cyanide dart trap built right into the architecture of the walls, triggered by pressure plates on the stairs themselves. Now, I have to stop here because human psychology under pressure is fascinating.
Oh, definitely.
You are in a blind panic. Wyverns are screaming up the stairs behind you. A dragon is tearing your friends apart downstairs. And you suddenly hit a pressure plate puzzle that requires intense focus. How do they not just freeze or make a panicked, fatal mistake?
Because they successfully process their fear into actionable steps rather than letting it paralyze them. In many narratives, heroes might try to use a levitation spell or, you know, attempt some impossible acrobatic flip to bypass a trap like this.
Right, some flashy magic.
But here, they look at the hazard itself and convert it into a solution. They use the environment. Morbidly so.
It is so macabre. They realize the dead dwarves on the stairs aren't heavy enough to trigger the plates anymore because they're just bones.
Right.
So Hannah and Rosie start grabbing these heavy dwarf skeletons and hurling them further up the stairs to intentionally trigger the pressure plates in advance, just exhausting the dart mechanisms.
Yeah, it's so smart.
And while the darts are firing harmlessly into the bones, they're gathering loose skeletal finger bones from the floor and physically jamming them into the tiny dart holes in the walls to plug them up.
It is grim ingenuity at its absolute finest. It perfectly highlights how combining diverse skill sets, like Rosie's animalistic sense of smell to detect the poison, combined with Hannah and Sam's rapid, unglamorous problem solving, turns a lethal roadblock into a solvable puzzle.
Yeah.
They don't panic. They don't look for an elegant solution. They look for the most effective one.
So they survive the stairs.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to imagine the physical toll. They drag themselves up those final steps, lungs burning, adrenaline crashing, and they finally burst into the room at the top of the tower where the dragon's heart is hidden. But instead of a straightforward objective, they hit a wall that has nothing to do with magic or monsters. They hit a severe biological roadblock.
They do. They enter the sunlit room at the top of the spire. Floating in the dead center is a massive, glowing crystal, the dragon's heart.
Okay.
But surrounding the room, acting as structural supports, are stone pillars banded in thick, heavy iron with massive dwarven warhammers resting against them.
Heavy iron. And here's where it gets really interesting. Because if we anchor this to the lore of Merari, we know why that specific metal matters so much.
It's a huge problem.
Both Hannah and Sam are creatures of pure Fae blood. And to the Fae, iron isn't just a heavy metal. It is deeply, violently toxic to their biology.
Right.
It is like a human walking into a reactor core without a hazmat suit. The radiation is palpable.
Just standing in a room with that much concentrated iron creates a suffocating, feverish heat for them. Their skin starts to react immediately. It is a literal oven, which just compounds the sheer exhaustion they already feel from the stairs.
So Hannah understandably tries to take the easy way out. She stays near the doorway, as far from the iron as possible, and shoots the floating crystal heart with the magic bow of light.
Which you'd think would work.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the crystal doesn't shatter. It just absorbs the magical arrow, glows brighter, and then violently fires dozens of duplicate light arrows back out like a deadly laser grid, shattering all the windows in the room.
It's completely counterproductive.
The magic completely fails. Why did the highly enchanted weapon fail? But the ultimate solution ended up being raw blunt force.
Because you have to understand the mechanics of the dragon's heart. It is an artifact of immense, concentrated, magical gravity. It's basically a magical sponge.
Oh, I see.
Firing an enchanted arrow at it is like plugging a massive power surge directly into a battery. It doesn't destroy the battery. It just overcharges it until the energy violently arcs back at you.
Right.
The only way to destroy it is to bypass the magic entirely and break the physical, crystalline housing of the heart. And the only non-magical tools available in that room heavy enough to do the job are the iron-studded dwarven warhammers.
which means Hannah has to touch the iron. She has to willingly grab a weapon that is actively destroying her cellular structure.
And this is the profound climax of the rescue, the true WHY of their victory. It wasn't won because Hannah was the strongest warrior with the highest stats.
Right.
It was won because she possessed an incredible capacity for self-sacrifice. She willingly endures excruciating agony. Her hands are blistering, bleeding, weeping from the severe chemical-like burns of gripping the iron studs.
It's awful to picture.
But she and Rosie the Doglin team up to lift this impossibly heavy warhammer together.
They swing it with absolutely everything they have left, and the blunt force manages to put a single deep fracture into the crystal. Hannah immediately collapses. I mean, her hands are completely destroyed. The string of her magic bow is snapped.
You're done.
But in a final act of desperation, she manages to load one last sputtering bolt of light into the broken bow and fires it directly into that physical crack they just made.
Yes.
And because the crystalline housing is compromised, the magical energy can't be absorbed. It bounces around inside the fracture until, boom, it shatters the heart entirely.
And the moment it breaks, downstairs in the gallery, Valenice the dragon instantly dissolves into mist.
The connection is severed. The physical threat is entirely eliminated.
Entirely.
You would think that is the end of the tension. You've slayed the dragon, you survived the traps, you thawed out the prisoners, everybody hugs, roll credits.
You'd hope so.
But thawing out these specific prisoners doesn't resolve the tension at all. It actually unleashes centuries of unresolved historical baggage.
Right, because after the dust settles, Hannah wakes up. Her hands are severely burned and bandaged. The group is using a magical heat-radiating dew claw they found in the dragon's hoard to slowly melt the ice around the prisoners.
Oh.
And they logically start with Lyne, the great mountain cat, Ice's great-grandfather.
And the second the magical ice melts off Lyne, instead of gasping for air and saying, "Thank you for saving my life," he instantly lunges across the room.
Instantly.
He pins Elysia, the bandit queen who just helped save them, to the floor, baring his teeth, completely intent on ripping her throat out.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, we really have to look at the psychology of being frozen in time.
What do you mean?
Well, Elysia, long before she became an ally to this group, was the villain who originally captured Lyne. She used him as bait to blackmail his adoptive father, forcing an oath that broke their family apart.
Okay.
Now, to the rest of the world, decades have passed. Elysia has lived a whole life, experienced regret, and changed. But for Lyne, the ice doesn't just freeze your body. It freezes your consciousness at the exact moment of your capture.
Oh, man, that makes so much sense. Because from his perspective, no time has passed. He is waking up mid-rage.
Exactly.
Milliseconds ago, in his mind, Elysia was actively destroying his family. It is complete chaos. You endure all this pain. You literally burn your own hands to save a guy. And his first instinct is to murder your teammate.
Yeah.
And the tension is palpable because Elysia doesn't fight back. She has dark magic. She could throw him off, but she goes completely limp.
She does. And this is a profound moment of atonement. Elysia refuses to raise a single hand to defend herself. She acknowledges that the pain she caused Lyne all those years ago was real and unjustified.
Wow.
She is fully prepared to accept his violent wrath as the ultimate price for her past sins.
But the group intervenes. And I love how incredibly messy and organic this intervention is. You have Hannah with her bandaged hands pleading with him on her honor.
Yeah.
You have Sam the Minstrel vouching for Elysia's character. And then you have Rosie the Doglin literally running right in between a giant, furious mountain cat and his prey, demanding to be petted in order to physically defuse the situation.
It is deeply animalistic, but also deeply empathetic. They manage to talk him down not by fighting him, but by giving him the context he has been denied.
Right.
They revealed the true fate of his father, Thomas. They explained that Thomas forgave him before he died and that Elysia has spent years genuinely seeking redemption. They provide the emotional closure that Valenice intentionally stole from him when she froze him.
Having narrowly avoided a brutal bloodbath born of ancient grudges, they finally move on to free the last prisoner in the gallery, Prince Feasel the Goblin.
Yes.
And after all this epic tragedy, the cyanide traps, the self-sacrifice, and the heavy emotional trauma, we get a scenario that is straight out of a romantic comedy.
It is the absolute perfect tonal shift. I mean, they melt the ice and Prince Feasel emerges. And instead of dropping to his knees in gratitude, he immediately starts complaining about his hometown.
Just immediately whining.
Yeah, he's talking about how the people back home eat books and how the maids use chamber pots as hats.
He is genuinely furious that they rescued him.
Yeah.
And then we get the twist. Fiesel actively wanted an impossible quest.
Right.
He went looking for the legendary bandit queen, knowing full well he'd probably never find her, just so he had an ironclad excuse to leave town and escape an arranged marriage to a fearsome goblin named Griselda.
He essentially exiled himself to a frozen wasteland to avoid an awkward social obligation.
You've probably heard of people faking a family emergency to get out of a bad blind date. But this guy literally let himself get captured by a dragon to get out of a wedding.
It's hilarious.
It is. And the group immediately shifts gears from saving the world to brainstorming elaborate ways to help this guy break off his engagement. They're throwing out the wildest ideas, like faking his death, telling her he contracted a terrible disease.
Sam the Minstrel even casually suggests a little assassination.
Naturally.
Yeah.
But then we get the final brilliant piece of world building that resolves it all organically. Alesia is examining Fiesel's royal goblin pendant, and she realizes something incredible.
Yeah, this part is great.
Decades ago, she gave up her firstborn child in a bargain for magical power. That child was eventually put in charge of the goblins, meaning Prince Fiesel is actually Alesia's biological grandson.
Which means Fiesel has fey blood.
Exactly.
And the mechanics of goblin royalty are notoriously obsessed with pure, unadulterated bloodlines. Because Fiesel has mixed fey heritage from Alesia, he is technically considered a mongrel by their societal standards.
Right.
Making him completely legally ineligible to marry pureblood goblin royalty anyway. The marriage contract is void. He's entirely off the hook.
It is such a brilliant, lighthearted cooldown to the entire story. After heavy themes of torture, self-sacrifice, and ancient hatred, the narrative grounds itself in this very relatable, very funny desire to just avoid a social commitment you were dreading.
It balances the heavy emotional lifting of the first half with a vital reminder that these characters, despite being legends, monsters, and heroes, still have to deal with everyday, mundane anxieties.
And that wraps up this incredibly wild deep dive into the world of Mirari. It wove together tactical combat, environmental puzzle solving, deep character sacrifices, and perfectly timed comedic relief.
It really had everything.
It did. So what does this all mean for you listening to this right now?
I think the biggest takeaway is looking at how this group actually succeeded. They didn't win because they had the biggest swords or the most raw power.
No, not at all.
They won because they leaned into their diverse, unique strengths and approached problems asymmetrically. It took a minstrel song to distract a narcissist. It took a doglin's nose to process fear into action.
Mm-hmm.
And it took a faely warrior's sacrificial bravery to bypass an unbreakable magic.
Absolutely. And to build on that, consider the thematic core of this entire adventure, which is the concept of being frozen.
Mm.
Valinese physically froze people in ice to preserve them as helpless trophies. But when the ice finally melted, we saw that Lion and Alesia were equally frozen in their own past grievances, guilt, and hatred.
Oh, that's so true.
The physical ice was gone, but the emotional ice remained until they actively chose to communicate and break it. Which leaves us with the question to mull over long after this deep dive ends. What ice pillars of pride, past arguments, or old resentments are you keeping yourself trapped in? And more importantly, what kind of sacrifice or difficult conversation would it take for you to finally shatter them?